little bit worried about how I was going to introduce this paper. But fortunately, Stephen Sedley has allowed me to do what I intended to, which is start off with stereotypes. We have two stereotypes, I think, of journalists today. A stereotype based on a good journalist, called the interest journalist, you know, the investigative journalist, knocking on doors, seeking out the truth, finding information which is of public benefit, and the bad journalist, the tabloid hack, the person interested in gossip, in celebrity, in scandal, in sensationalisation. And they'd be working for a media company which is interested in sales and profit and very little else. And if we use that idea of stereotypes, these two different types of journalists also have two different types of confidential sources which they rely upon. The good sources, the whistleblower, the policy insider that can give off the record or deep background information to the journalist, and the bad sources, the corrupt official, disloyal servant, friend. The Mr. Dell, Mr. Apple, Mr. Samsung Galaxy, if need be. And if that doesn't happen, we'll just make up some story and say it's from a confidential source. Leveson deals with both good and bad sources. And most of my articles really concerned about the bad sources. But before I go into that, it is worth noting some of the things he does say about dealing with good sources or potentially good sources. He's very keen on records being kept of meetings between senior politicians and senior police officers. He's now saying that the terminology used when it comes to police briefings of what previously were off-the-record briefings should now be non-reportable, just in case journalists don't understand the boundaries of what they've been given. But what I want to do is I really want to talk about the bad sources and what Leveson was able to do when his investigation found, not industrial scale, but a frequent amount of hacking, blagging, fabrication, paying of corrupt sources to get information which had very little public benefit or public interest. This casual reliance on bad sources was made by journalists in the knowledge that the law would protect them because they could hide their criminality behind the assertion that I've got this information from a confidential source. And domestic law and European law has protected all confidential sources in the same way, on the belief that this protects the public watchdog role of the press. So there was not much that Leveson could do to change the law when it came to restricting the amount of use of bad sources. What he had to do, and what he ended up being forced to do, was making recommendations in relation to practices within the press. Changes really to the ethical rules of conduct. He talks about transparency. He talks about the new regulatory body should consider encouraging the press to be as transparent as possible in relation to sources used for stories, including providing any information that would help readers to assess the reliability of information from a source. Yeah. If you're going to use a confidential source, at the very least, give an indication of who that person is, and not, you know, some form of partial attribution, basically. He endorsed Baroness O'Neill's view that the default position should be that sources be fully attributed, and that anonymity should only be there if there was a strong public interest with doing so. And he also called for enhanced editorial control or scrutiny. He said the lack of supervision and excessive degree of trust may well have fostered a culture in which journalists feel able to publish stories on the basis of a single, unverified source. And what this suggests is something which I think is been largely neglected in the debate about Leveson, and that's better internal controls at the newspapers. We all talk about the regulation, the new regulator or regulators which we set up, but they're a fallback position. Their complaint procedure is there when the internal procedures break down. So if there's an internal complaint procedure, there may also be an opportunity to create codes or practices at the press level which will enhance the way in which journalists use confidential sources. I talk in my article about codes of practices from around the world, and I use quite a lot of North American sort of codes, both industry codes and actually individual media organ codes, which require some prior step to be taken before a journalist uses a confidential source. And if I'm going to sort of talk about the actual principles, just what they involve, very quickly without going into the details of any codes, quite often you see requirements that a confidential source is used as a last resort. There's a need for verification, receiving data from a second source, some confirmation of the information given. Editorial approval is frequently required, and in some codes the knowledge of the name of a confidential source is demanded before any publication. There's provisions which remind the journalist to consider the motive. You know, could there be some ill will on behalf of the source, which means he wants to cloak himself in cloak of anonymity to launch a personal attack. And some codes say you can't do that. You can't allow the anonymous sources to launch personal attacks. Other codes say the confidential source can only be used if the information is of paramount importance to the readership or of public interest. And there is other provisions and other codes talking about its avoidance in run-the-mill cases, and if it is to be used, then it has to be an accurate attribution. I want now to look at the second part of my paper, which is how this idea of the importance of confidential sources has also given an additional layer of protections to journalists, which does hinder police investigations when it comes to discovering their involvement in criminal activities. And this relates to the law regarding searches or would-be searches of journalistic premises. There is a special regime in the Police and Criminal Evidence Act which largely avoids this, which says that in the case of journalistic material and in the case of confidential information which is given to journalists, excluded material, they are subjected to special rules. Special rules, which means that ultimately it's left to the newspaper or the media company to produce the evidence, to give access to the police if there's a court order, which won't be ordered unless certain access conditions are sort of satisfied. And amongst those access conditions, and I'm only going to mention a few, are that what the police are seeking is information about an indictable offence, and there's reasonable grounds to believe that's occurred, and the material is likely to be of substantial value, and that other methods of obtaining the material have been tried without success. If we look at the inquiries into phone hacking, or particularly the first inquiry Operation Caryatid, the police describe the experience of trying to conduct the investigation as being one which was severely hampered by the news of the world. They'd arrested Clive Goodman, the royal correspondent who had used the information from the hacking of the royal household. They'd arrested him, and they went to the News of the World to search the premises. Under Section 18 of the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, once you've arrested a person, you can make reasonable searches. And when they were there, they were met by editorial staff, by the security guards at the News of the World, and told that their search was unlawful, that they couldn't continue because their search would reveal journalistic material, and they were basically escorted off the premises in what was described as a Mexican standoff. And what was very clear was that the police were unhappy with that. You see in the John Yates's evidence to the inquiry a justification as to why the original operation into phone hacking only resulted in two arrests. He gives two reasons. One, he talks about 9/11 and the need to move resources to dealing with anti-terrorism activities. But the other is that they were essentially hindered by the News of the World, by News International, because initially of this sort of Mexican standoff, but later because they had taken over News International lawyers had taken over this sort of investigation and were and had created this veneer of apparent cooperation, which in the eyes of the police prevented them from seeking a production order. The News of the World would argue, well, we are giving you all the information you are seeking, so you do not need this court order to do that. Historically, if we look back at what's happened in time, it seems that that initial investigation by Burton and Copeland and the News of the World's own sort of investigators was inadequate. There may be suggestions that they found stuff which they didn't pass on to the police, but we'll never know. That hasn't come out in the way that perhaps it should. That led to the proposals in the final submission of Metropolitan Police to make changes to the special protections for journalistic materials. I'm running out of time, so I'm not going into detail about them, but essentially one of the requirements they wanted to remove was that the police needed to be unable to get the information by other means, basically meaning that the police just went to court and got the order. There's also some desire to define journalism on the basis of the Sugar and BBC test, which I'm not sure what it really adds to the issue from the point of view of the police. And the final element, which I think is a little bit more controversial, is removing the protection afforded to journalistic materials when the material in question has been received as a consequence of a crime. The requirement for there to be a lawful undertaking in relation to confidentiality, which seems to me to allow the police to ignore certain of those protections in relation to the special procedure, excluded material sort of procedures, in the case of, say, the Official Secrets Act. So if you've got a document which is only could have come from a civil servant or security services member, the police can more or less go straight in without the protections. And I'm not sure whether the suggestion of the Metropolitan Police is that they should just get a search power or whether it's just an amendment to the general powers. I'm uncertain exactly what they're going for. So that's essentially all I really want to say. looking particularly for comments regarding production orders, because that's something which I do feel I need a little bit more sort of information about.